Seascapes is 30 years old, and I've been looking back again at some of the archives from the early days of the programme. The programme was started by Tom McSweeney back in 1989, and he had a whole series of interviews with people who were, at that stage, very elderly, looking back at their time at sea. The first person we're going to hear from tonight is called Jack O'Creenan. He's from Ballinacurra in East Cork. He was aged 80 when he did this interview back in 1992, and his family owned one of the last sailing-only schooners operating around the Irish coast.
She was built in 1859. We had the flying jib, the boat. She was 100 feet long by 23 feet beam, I think it was. And we had the flying jib and the boom jib and the standing jib and the staysail and the fore and the main and the mizzen, the upper topsail and the lower topsail, the main topsail and the mizzen gaff topsail. And then when, if the wind was right behind you, you would take down the staysail and put up the squaresail and you'd be going away a free sheet all the time.
What was life like aboard?
Tough. Oh, Jill, we used to fill coal and that kind of thing, you know. We didn't get 220 tons, she'd take of coal. And then we'd come up here and we'd load malt and take that from to Dublin. But to take us maybe from here to Dublin, 1933, I think it was. There was my father, my brother and myself. There were only the three of us in there. It was the month of December. Up came a little air wind. And we got us outside the harbour and we went well off because the wind was light southwest. And then we went away down for the Tusker. We got down to the Tusker. That was Saturday night. There was a gale of wind came up from the southeast and we were bound to Dublin. And of course that was right into old Barrow and my father and my brother and they were running a lot around livelier than what I was, and you know. And we were in rings in next morning, they all thought we were gone, thank God. My father took off his hat, off his head, and he knelt down the deck. He said, there'll never again be three Creenans in the Brooklands. Two dangers. They were, you know, we had everything offered that night. The only thing we had on them was the flying jib, I think, and the stays, the foresail, and the lower topsail. It was tough. Tough job, you'd want to be fit, and there was a lot of hardship in it, and there was bad times in it, because there was Great Depression, the little bit that I was at it, there was a lot of depression, and money was scarce, and it was hard to get work, you know, you'd be taking coal around that time for they're talking about the miners now. I remember in Cardiff and Swansea and Port Talbot and Britain Ferry and all those places, Lydney, Newport and all the Bristol Channel there, you'd be buying coal maybe £4 or £5 a ton, £4 or £5.
And of course, unloading and loading, it was a very physical job. There wasn't the modern equipment there now.
But there was hobblers here. There were hobblers all around Ireland, what they call hobblers. They'd go down from here down to Tusker in the punt, 15 or 16 foot, and after going down, they mightn't get the job at all. First the board, they get the job. And they come up here and they'd be filling that for fourpence a ton. For the merchants, fourpence a ton. And they'd be at it morning, noon and night.
What happened to the Brooklands eventually?
1953. She founded off the Tusker. There was a man took her over, and he, as far as I'm aware, he was taking her to Dublin to survey. She was, you know, she'd have to be passed, you know. She was always a 101 at Lloyd's, but she was going up to Dublin. We had nothing to do with her then, 1953. We were finished with her. This man had her on lease.
I see.
There was some controversy about her. And
she found it on the Tusker?
She found it down off the Tusker. There was no one with her. There was no one lost with her. I think that was July 1953.
You were saying there that when you met people on ships, there was a great camaraderie, a great friendship amongst them.
Ah, there was, because at that time, you know, you wouldn't be the only pebble in the beach, you know. Well, there was great unity there. You know, the men, they were all great men, hard men, but great men.
And finally, you were saying you'd always trust somebody who'd been at sea.
Oh, always. I found them. They were very honest people. They were, you know, there was something about them. They had great nature. If you were going west now, if the lads were off trawl and they're out of Castletown Bear or any of them places there, they'd give you Skull or Goaline or Crookhaven, they call it them, where they were. They'd throw you an old bucket of fish if they see you, you know, if they were. They taught you one, if you were outside, they'd come alongside and you would get a bucket of fish. You wouldn't be hungry at all.
And that was 80-year-old Jack O'Creenan back in 1992. One of the regular and most frequent contributors to Seascapes over the 30 years has been WM Winky Nixon. This is his very first contribution to Seascapes for 1993, and he's talking about cruising around Ireland.
Sailing to islands is the very essence of cruising. After all, a well-found cruising boat going about her business on the high seas is herself, in many ways, a miniature island. So when you do get to your chosen island destination, you're in natural sympathy with the people who live in it. Or so at least you may like to think. The truth is that most people who live in islands see the sea in purely utilitarian terms. They probably reckon that anyone who sails in it for fun is at least one crew being short of a supper. Be that as it may, you bring with you the excitement of navigating your own craft to be there, rather than using mundane forms of public transport. Well, perhaps mundane is scarcely the word to describe some of the boats which serve the smaller islands. Getting them to put to sea at all is sometimes an achievement. So, having a boat of your own gives a greater sense of freedom, so much so that we have often spent an entire crew sailing from one small island to another, the whole venture being completed without calling at any mainland port until we finally come home. The excitement of arriving at a new island is always fresh. At first, if visibility is good, it appears as a smudge in the horizon, and then as you sail nearer, its coastal details begin to emerge. Headlands and small fields and isolated cottages dotted on the peaceful hillside, contrasting with the vivid movement of the sea. You will, of course, have a preconceived notion of what it's going to be like ashore, but part of the charm of cruising is that such places seldom turn out exactly as you expect. Often, they're much better. And as well, when we arrive in port, being an average cruising crew, we'll be much too busy having a full and frank exchange of views as to where we should moor in order to take any great notice of our new surroundings. So when peace finally breaks out aboard, we step ashore into a completely new world. It's a world which we usually prefer to be at least slightly inhabited. Off the Irish coast, deserted islands tend to be sad places. Thus, although we've visited three of the islands in Ireland's four corners, that is, Cape Clear down in the southwest, Tory up off the northwest, and Rathlin off the northeast, somehow we've never got around to calling at the uninhabited Great Saltee off the southeast corner. But maybe that's something to look forward to. Meantime, we've special memories of the other three islands. There's the magic of welcoming the summer outside Paddy Burke's on Cape Clear, Ireland's most southerly public house. As for Tory Island and its very special people, the only way to appreciate their achievement in being islanders at all is to sail your own boat there. And off the northeast corner, in the tide-riven Sea of Moyle, there's the rugged Rathlin Island whose people reflect the fact that they're midway between County Antrim and Scotland. In other words, in daylight hours at least, they're people of few words. Some cruising folk I know were there when the harbour was being improved, and when a man of Rathlin came down the pier, they asked him if the building put up near the harbour was a new harbour office. He simply replied, no. So they asked him if it wasn't the harbour office, then what was it? It's the new pub, was all he'd say. And what, the visiting sailors inquired with some desperation, what became of the old pub? It got wore out.
Over the 30 years, we've been on every type of boat you could think of. Tall ships, small ships, dinghies, motorboats, and tugboats. Back in 1991, Tom McSweeney was on the Bin Eider tug coming out of Dublin Port. The skipper was George Elliott.
The Japanese car vessel called the Aijin, she's coming in here with a couple of hundred cars. She'll dock around 4 o'clock. She's to sail tonight at 10:30. We will pick her up down the river, one tug forward and the Bin Eider aft, using the tug's lines. She's going into Alex Key 38, head west. The job will take around 3/4 of an hour. From the time you have to tow and time you let go. And it's quite a tricky operation. Over Force 5, we don't normally handle these vessels because of their size and the strength of the wind. But you just have to take it more carefully, and with the help of the pilot, the ship's engines and ourselves, we managed them very, very well.
How long have you been on the tugs, George?
I'm 21 years here now.
You must know Dublin Bay then like the back of your hand.
Well, quite well. My father was actually a tugboat skipper here. He passed a lot of the information on to skippers that came afterwards, like Paddy Scanlon, who taught me most of the stuff I know today. It'd be very, very, very helpful over the years. And so we have sort of developed quite a lot of skills ourselves in the meantime, and we hope to improve as time goes by, really. So other than that, now, the job is quite interesting.
George was assigned the stern position, which meant he'd be taking up station, steering and moving astern himself all the time as well, keeping pace with the huge vessel and steadying it. While another tug, the Clewan Tariff, was at the bow, under the command of Patsy Murphy, while pilot Paddy Tyndall had gone aboard the Japanese ship. It all seemed a tricky enough task.
It is, really. With this boat now, she's a Weichneider water tractor, and she's highly manoeuvrable. So with the result, you can get into any position or any situation. You'll get out of it no problem once you keep your wits about you. The whole secret with the white tractor tugs is not to get caught in the wash, like, because we've a skeg aft here, and once you sort of get caught in the wash of the ship will push you either across it. So with the result, you're zigzagging across the wash all the time. The whole secret really is to stay either on the port side or on the starboard side off the wash, so that it's going down your side, and that way you can keep better control over the tug. So we just keep a minimum weight here and just go gently astern with the vessel as she proceeds up the river there.
Back on the tow work, people often wonder, how can a small vessel exert so much pulling power on much bigger ships?
You don't have to exert an awful lot of pressure. It's just being in the right position at the right time to counteract any sort of swings that are necessary.
And you're staying now on her port
quarter.
Deliberately, in order not to get caught in her way.
Well, not really. See, at the moment, you have the slight draw of west-south-west wind here. And so the ship's head will be going up into the wind all the time. So just to keep her straight, we'll come out on the port quarter and just exert a little pressure, straighten her out, and then ease back again. And as she proceeds again, she'll probably go back up to the south again, her head will go back into the wind. So we just keep repeating the procedure until we're up off the Isle Bears before we make the swing.
It's a fair deal of a vessel to have to control, though. On a stormy or a windy day, you know, this must be a real pressure thing, watching it the whole time.
Well, you have to watch it all the time, and especially with this type of boat, the tug, you see, responds the minute you hit the helm. She's one of these variable pitch jobs, and the minute you take her hand off her, she'll go away. So you've got to be watching her all the time, plus the fact that you're watching the ship as well. But with the pilot now on board here, Paddy Tyndall, Paddy's extremely good pilot, and you won't have any problems with him. He sort of tacks up the river most times when he's quite good at that.
Another regular contributor was Dr. John De Courcy Ireland, who was also a huge supporter of the programme.
Dr. John De Courcy Ireland is probably Ireland's best voice in our maritime history. He joins us now with the story of famous Dublin shipbuilding families and Irish seafarers who became French privateers and won the Mayor of Dunkirk.
Cork, Dungarvan and Waterford were main shipbuilding towns in the 18th century, followed by Dublin, where four families, Murphys, Cardiffs, Keoghs and Kirks, were celebrated for the ships they built. Derry, Carlingford and Donaghadee in the late 18th century built Irish ships too, and Irish ships were frequenting the West Indies with cargoes of salt fish and salted meat and returning with sugar and rum. And they were also carried out a highly profitable trade with Portugal in butter, returning with wine and fruit. And it was in the 18th century that scores of Irish seamen took service in France in its frequent wars with England as privateers, some making fortunes, one becoming even mayor of the city of Dunkirk.
Norman Freeman is an author, a radio operator and a mariner. He was a frequent contributor to the programme and here he recounts a journey through the Panama Canal.
When the overweight pilot climbed up to the bridge of our ship, he said in a breathless voice, "Well, guys, I'm going to take it from one ocean to another." There were flurries of anticipation among crew and passengers of the city of Brooklyn. We looked ahead towards the entrance to the Panama Canal. Many came out on deck to watch. In the distance, we could see the dense green tropical jungle steaming under the blazing sunshine. Far away, we could make out the mountain ridge that runs down the spine of the Isthmus of Panama. We were going to move along one of the most extraordinary feats of engineering and construction ever achieved by mankind, a canal that connects the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. Since this mammoth task was completed in 1914, it has become a pivotal channel of international maritime trade. As we went slowly from Cologne Bay into the canal, we could see ahead the massive set of locks. We would enter them, then let the water lift us up by 26 metres until we were able to emerge into Gatun Lake. When we had gone the length of this stretch of water, we would enter a canal that ran along a gigantic groove that had been hacked out of the mountain ridge. Then a series of locks would lower us back down to sea level and we would emerge into the Pacific Ocean and head for Australia. The idea of gouging out a waterway across the relatively narrow length of land had aroused the interest and imagination of many for several centuries. Ships travelling between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans had no option but to traverse the length and dangerous route by Cape Horn on the southern tip of South America. Between 1881 and 1889, the French made two attempts at a canal. Both failed because of the immensity of the task, the huge costs involved, and the prevalence of yellow fever that had killed many thousands of workers. The US government decided to take on the challenge in 1904. It had most to gain from a greatly shortened sea route between their east and west coasts. The notion of a sea level canal was found impossible due to flooding during the rainy season. A system of locks was decided on. By that time, significant progress had been made in the fight against yellow fever. A Cuban doctor, Carlos Finlay, put forward the theory that a mosquito was the prime carrier of the organism that caused yellow fever. In 1900, his conclusions were fully accepted by a US commission led by the distinguished military physician, Dr. Walter Reed. Reed and his colleagues conducted intensive experiments and research that proved conclusively what Finlay had found. Fully aware of the work of Finlay and Reed, the canal construction team began an intensive program of spraying the mosquito-breeding swamps and ponds with larvicide or oils, fumigating buildings, installing sanitation systems. The death rate amongst workers notably declined, although 5,600 workers died of accidents and disease during the 10 years of construction. With great enterprise, the US designed and manufactured massive construction equipment and used it with great vigor. Enormous dredges scooped out soil. Power drills hammered relentlessly into rock that was then smashed by giant hydraulic crushers. The work was most intense when cutting through the mountain range. Over 100 mammoth steam shovels mounted on railway tracks carried away millions of tons of soil and stone. Steam-powered cranes moved up and down the site. Cement mixers churned away night and day. At either end, huge breakwaters were laid down to facilitate easy entrance and exit into the two oceans. It took great effort and enormous cost to complete this gigantic project. As our ship was leaving Gatun Lake to enter the final set of locks, our captain looked ahead through his binoculars. He called out, "Yes, yes, I can see the Pacific Ocean. Hats off to all who made this seventh wonder of the modern world."
And that was Norman Freeman. Our last look at the archives tonight is an interview with Ozzie Bennett, going back to 1992. He met Tom McSweeney in his home in County Kilkenny and spoke about his time at sea in the 40s and 50s.
They were really bad. It was 4 hours on and 4 hours off. That was until you got into port and dim days. And food wasn't good, anything wasn't wonderful aboard the ship in them days.
Now, you were an engineer, so that meant steam, fire?
Steam, fire, everything that was there and so forth. The coal was really bad in them days. Everything was bad. You got the worst of everything. There was a war on and you got nothing, only dirt. And had the same thing happened. And the railways here in Ireland, they had nothing, only turf and real slack coal, etc., and so forth.
It must have been hard going then, Osmond, below decks, shoveling fires, feeding fires, drawing them when you had to.
Well, it was really rough. It was really rough down. It was really rough in the stoke hole. It was really rough. In them days, you had to be a lion. It was only lions of men that stuck the like of it, you know. Not so bad in the winter time, but in the summer time when the weather was warm, it was a rough place. The engine room was rough in all them ships. Engine room, you went in under the engines to oil them, you wouldn't get your breath. You wouldn't get your breath. And the way it was good, the heat that was there, you hadn't the best of stuff. You had valves leaking, you had packing and bad packing and glands and so forth, and it was a rough job. It was a rough job.
And the pictures we see nowadays of men in those days, stripped of the waist, blackened, shoveling away, sweating, would they be the correct type of pictures that
they were? They were definitely the correct type of pictures. They were definitely the right thing. And sometimes your fellas had to go up and enter small pockets above and trim down the coal inside pure and not coal in them days, it was only slack. And they'd be up to their knees in old slack and trying to push it out through holes and down there and so forth. And it was rough. It was really rough going in them days.
Of course, during the war years.
That was during the war years.
That was when the men of Irish shipping really kept this nation fed and supplied, wasn't it?
That's quite right. We had a very fine crew on the Irish Ford. There were a lot of lads that I took away from home and so forth and from all around my own place at home. But she was very small, crossing the Atlantic. She was only about 2,000 tons.
Why was she called a submarine?
She was the smallest ship, one of the smallest ships that kept continually crossing the Atlantic, winter and summer. And because she was half of it was under the water, half its time going out in heavy seas to come in one side and be throwing it out the other side. I remember leaving Cork Harbour, leaving Cork in real bad weather with the Irish Fur. And it took 32 days from the mouth of the Cork Harbour to St. John's, New Brunswick. We kept belting away and we... And next year, I went into my dinner one day and the captain said to me, he said, "Where there was a torpedo, have you a torpedo below in the engine room?" He says to me, "Oh, in the name of goodness, says I have enough of trouble in the engine room." I said, "Well, there was a torpedo fired at us," he says, "and it came straight for you in the engine room." When I said, "I haven't it below there, I have trouble enough, but I haven't that there," I said, "I can do without that." I thought he was going crazy. So that was all right. We got into the bay of Fundy. And I pumped salt water into the boat boilers for to get me into St. John's, New Brunswick. And I had to blow down the boilers inside and mashed up between the tubes, salt and so forth, and try to clean them out. Real hard work. Do you know what I mean? Hard going. And it was years afterwards that a commander wrote a book of all the ships he sunk. And he said that the Irish Fur was the luckiest ship afloat, he says. In the bad weather, we had a neutral line to go on. And we were in the bad weather, we were blown into the line belonged to the English, where the English ships go, like, more or less. And he fired a torpedo at it. And what he never saw before... That happened to him. It came up on two waves, and he said,
the torpedo went out under it. And he had the periscope on it, he said, and he saw the Irish flag on the side of it, and he picked up the name Irish Far on it, and he didn't fire any more. So the captain was right, I was wrong. It was just a miracle that I am here. But I was very lucky. I should have gone in the pine. If I went in the pine, it wouldn't be found either. I had a few and had escapes.
Osmond Bennett from 1992.